With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
So I went to that school. After 9 months, I was completely hooked. I thought, this is my life. This is what I'm going to do. This is amazing. And then they kicked me out of school.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jamie.
I'm Amy, and this is Clever. Today, we are talking to the one and only Marcel Wanders. He's a rock star of design known the world over for infusing his work with irreverent humor, poetry, and romance. Work which spans the spectrum from in-flight tableware to cosmetics packaging to high-end hospitality interiors.
His dreamlike furniture and lighting is unmistakable, from the renowned knotted chair to the curvaceous tulip chair or the curious snotty vase. Based in Amsterdam, he's the head of his namesake design studio, which does work for private clients and premium brands such as Capellini, Alessi, Bisazza, Floss, Louis Vuitton, Swarovski, Moy, and many others.
He's rich on personality and intrigue. Let's talk to Marcel.
Here's Marcel Wanders on a table in one of the meeting rooms of my studio in Amsterdam, looking to the screen with two beautiful girls. And I am designer, I'm art director, and I lead a team of 50 people here in Amsterdam who every day work their butt off on interior design and product design. I'm art director of Moy, which is a company that works with designers around the world to create iconic furniture and lighting. I love design because it's a possibility for creators to do something that really reaches people. The intimacy of product design and the intimacy of interiors is so beautiful and so overwhelming sometimes that I really feel that I can do important stuff. I can really take people on a journey. I can give them something that makes them feel different about themselves. To have that feeling that you really do something that makes people's imagination go or makes them feel something unique about themselves or makes them able to step into an unforeseen, beautiful future, to be part of that journey of people around the world is something amazing. It's something that keeps me busy since the last 25 years.
Well, let's rewind back further than 25 years. Oh. Let's rewind all the way back.
I wasn't born then.
Young Marcel. Young Marcel.
Oh, yes.
Paint the picture of your childhood for us. Where were you born? What was your family dynamic like? What kind of kid were you?
I was the middle kid of five. And mom and dad, they had a store. And so if stuff broke down, which always happens in the store, of course, then I got it and I took a screwdriver or a hammer and I took it apart. And I was always interested in looking at things and just investigating things and putting it together again. I was always studying these things. I had a bike. I was always, you know, making crazy shit with my bike, you know, making crazy steering wheels, making my bike run backwards if I was pedaling forwards, repairing bikes with a rope for 2 days, but it worked, and, you know, stuff like that. And on top of that, I had my own little workshop. I loved making gifts for people. Basically, it started, of course, that, you know, I made stuff and I gave it to someone. And that was always like, positive feedback. Everybody loved me. So let's do that more, right? Of course.
What kind of gifts would you make?
I would glue a piece of crystal to a piece of wood and just paint it with green and yellow, and then, you know, pack it in a blue paper with a ribbon, whatever. It was nothing special, I think, but, you know, I made things.
I love knowing that crystals came into your life, though, from a very early age.
Basically, if stuff breaks, you get crystals, right? It's how it goes. I found things and I put them together. Maybe I painted a face on it. I don't know. But I was making things. I learned a few important things when making things and giving them to people. That still, you know, is really what gives me pleasure today.
And were your parents supportive of you tinkering around and making your bike go backwards when you pedaled forward?
Yeah, I mean,
was that something that was supported and celebrated in your household?
Yeah, I mean, my parents loved that. You know, I could keep myself busy, let's say it that way, because it made it easy for them to spend a lot of time with the other four. No, I had my own space in the attic, a little room with all my stuff, and you know, I just had a lot of fun there. My father, mother, I mean, there's no creativity runs through the veins of my family, but, you know, they were super happy. I like to draw, I like to make things, and they were always supportive of it.
Let's move into adolescence, because adolescence is a time where some kids feel like very angsty, or they feel like they really need to express themselves, rebel against their parents. What kind of teenager were you?
I was extremely rebellious.
Not surprised.
I had no choice also. My parents were wonderful people, but super old-fashioned, and I was going to change the world, so that was not easy. And so obviously I had to fight a lot, and not only I think at home, but you know, also in other things. I had my own band. I played the bass guitar and I sang, and we were doing rock and roll, and we're doing all kinds of crazy shit. And then you live in Amsterdam, so you know, there's all this stuff that you have to try, of course. So altogether, it was a bouncy ride. But I think I had a good upbringing. So at some point, things turn out for the better. You have to experiment. You have to do all these things to become yourselves, right? It's easy to be a child of your parents, but then at some point, you have to also become yourself. And that doesn't automatically fly. That comes with pain. That comes with experiments and with a lot of fun also, of course.
At what point did you discover art or design as something that you really wanted to get into and go to college to study?
I think 15, 16 or so. And I wanted to do something creative. I always kind of knew that that was something I wanted. But, you know, design, maybe it did exist. I had no idea of it. And someone told me about landscape architecture. And I had my own plant corner in the house, and I was putting stuff together and gluing plants together and, you know, making weird combinations. And that was nice. And so I went to this school for a day to check it out. And then at the end of the day, I wasn't so excited because, you know, everybody was wearing green boots all day. I'm like, I'm not going to wear green boots all my life. That's not me. So then I decided that's not me. So then for 2 years, I studied some other stuff. And then someone told me there's something like design, which, you know, I had no idea of. And, you know, quite a while ago, design was not ubiquitously present as it became later. But, you know, to make a toaster and maybe a vacuum cleaner, you know, sounded like an amazing thing. So I went to that school. After 9 months, I was completely hooked. I thought, this is my life. This is what I'm going to do. This is amazing. And then they kicked me out of school.
Oh, no. What happened?
What?
Yeah, no talent. Yeah, probably no talent.
Wait.
I did interviews with the teachers who kicked me out later also, just to frustrate them a little bit. But also to get more clarity, because, of course, people, they tried to do their best for me also. But, I mean, the school back then, it was a very, like, Bauhaus-oriented, you know, bit classical design school, like most schools, probably all schools in those days were. And I was, you know, experimenting. I was trying stuff out, and I was just not following maybe the rules so much. I was just trying to make them or try to do something different, because I thought that was so cool about design, that you would do something in a different way and not in the same way. And so, yeah, basically my attitude to experimentation and tremendous passion that I have in everything that I do was a bit challenging for the teachers, I think. And so I tried to find another school that would want to have me, which is not so easy.
Did that feel like a rejection, or did that feel like an affirmation of your pioneering, rebellious, groundbreaking spirit?
It was awful. I think I was 19 years old, not the age that you want to cry in the corner of your school, but I did. I was devastated. I'm like, this is what I want to do, and this is the school I have to be. It's my first huge, big failure. It's like I was devastated, really devastated.
How did you recover from that?
Fortunately, that became anger, which is a very positive positive energy if you want to get something done.
It's a fiery fuel. That's true.
Yeah. So I went to a school in Maastricht that wanted to have me, which is really not the best school. But, they wanted to have me. And then the year after, I started studying also on another school. So I did one day school, which is more about jewelry, and another school that was really about industrial design. But that was in the evenings and the weekends. So I did two schools. And then at the end, I stopped with these two. And I went to another school, which is in Arnhem. By then, my luck had turned. I started to understand what design was. I won a few design prizes already. My work was exhibited in important exhibitions while I was in school. Some products were in production. The Olympic Games would come to Amsterdam. So there was a question, who could design the prizes for the Olympic Games? And so I thought it was cool. At the end, there was like 76 students who brought their work to the jury. And out of the 76, 66 were from design school, the school that I was kicked out of. And then there was me. And so these 66 kids all had been working together with the teachers for 3 months, whatever, to do all this. And I had done my proposal just in my evening hours, because basically my school didn't support this whole idea. And then I won. I won. Out of
vindication.
Right. And I remember to the day that, I was working so hard and I was pushing so hard, and there was nothing I didn't study. There was no moment that I didn't think of all the big players and all the thoughts I could think of. But that was suddenly I felt, I'm done. I'm accomplished. I'm ready. For 2 weeks, I did at least nothing. There's nothing. And then, of course, start to move ahead. But I remember that I felt like I'm basically done. I have proven my point and I'm going to be a great designer. And yeah, that was cool.
After graduating and feeling like you've arrived and you're clearly on your way to becoming the world's leading designer.
Right.
Okay, so how do you take those few steps into the professional?
After these 2 weeks, I became a little bit more modest, of course, right? You understand that.
I'm sure.
It was just 2 weeks yes. of pleasure. And then, of course, there was big problems and I had to study again. And I have to save the world. I have to try to find a way to do this job. And, of course, hard work.
Well, how did you do that? What were the first few steps into the professional world for you?
I was lucky because the last years of my school, again, what I said, some work was in production. I had won a few prizes. I had work in big exhibitions. So by then I was a bit known here in this little country. So it's not a lot, but for that moment it was a lot. So my work was presented in the National Design Magazine on the cover and published with 8 or 9 pages. So it was really ridiculous in a way. And so automatically I had quite some work also. Quite a lot of it was, of course, very cultural work. One of the projects was a project for KLM. I was asked to do the business class service, the in-flight service. So I did that, and there was 3 other groups that also were in 2 big studios here in the Netherlands, and then also Bordjik Sipek was asked. So I was the brookie, the little guy, and then there was Bordjik Sipek, which was at the top of his career. And of course, these 2 big studios, they won because KLM was super happy to work with a serious company and not with two crazy people. And I got to talk with these guys, and the studio that won the competition, they asked me, Marcel, don't you want to come work with us? And I thought, this is great. I can really do a few years of real practice and not only cultural stuff, but real stuff, right? Real work. And so I said, okay, I'll come work with you. If I get paid more than any other designer in the team, I'll be there only for 3 years. I'll pick my own project, and the first project that I want to do is the KLM project. And they said, yes, okay, of course. And so I was there for 3 years working on the KLM project and so many others. And it was an amazing time. It was an amazing time. I did all kinds of interesting stuff for telecom. I did stuff for pregnancy tests. I did, you know, all kinds of stuff and learned a lot from a fantastic team of really great designers.
That does sound really, really exciting. I'm also very impressed and a little bit jealous of your ballsiness to just demand what you want and then get it.
Yeah, I had my own studio, and my studio was having a lot of work. So I had to stop, you know, for 2-3 years, my company, which was nothing, but yeah, it was my company, right? I'm like, okay, I will do it. But, you know, basically you're buying my company for a few years, so you better, you know, come up with something.
Sure.
If they wouldn't have done it, it would be also fine. So they were cool with it. I was cool with it. And we had a wonderful time.
You've had a long career with many dazzling chapters.
Before I started there, it was like one and a half year, and then I worked with them for 3 years. Then I started a studio together with three others. We shared a space, but basically I started my own studio, which moved then to Amsterdam later. And that's what I'm doing since. But there's all kinds of steps, of course. 2001, then suddenly there's Moy, and we start to do interior design. So there's quite a few big, important steps in my life, of course, like in the life of everybody, right? You get married, you get a baby, you know, big things.
Oh, yeah. Tell us about these big, important steps.
Let's see, big picture. Coming out of school, working for 3 years at Landmark, setting up my studio in Rotterdam, then 3 years later, moving to Amsterdam, then making the Not a Chair, working with Capellini, making the Airborne Snotty Vase, then setting up Moy, doing my first interior project, the big one in Miami. My daughter gets born. Lately, I did a big exhibition on my work in the Stedelijk Museum in Amsterdam. So yeah, a few highlights. Here and there.
Yes.
Just a few.
Yeah, just a few. When your daughter was born, did that shift your perspective at all? Did that bring anything into focus, or did that change your priorities? How did that affect you and your work?
No, not at all. I think really, it sounds really awful. I'm an awful father. I'm not. I have a wonderful relationship, an extremely nice daughter, which, you know, I have a great relationship with. But basically, I don't know. I didn't start suddenly to make children's toys or, you know, all that stuff. I didn't suddenly start to work less, you know. Really didn't change so much for me. I just felt, you know, of course, more whole, and I felt more responsible. But, you know, I always felt responsible for a lot of things. It didn't really make a big difference. I think over time, my daughter became more important when she grew older. Today, I think it is more meaningful for me than, you know, when she was born. That's maybe weird, but if I'm honestly, that's basically it. But, you know, I never felt that there is any competition between my family or my work. I've always took the time to be there with my family, and I always took the time for my work. The only one who maybe didn't get time enough sometimes was me. But I'm super okay with that. I have not too many needs on that point. Me time,
right? Yeah, self care.
Yeah, I don't need it so much. I mean, if I'm with my family or I'm at work, that's me time, right? I don't need nothing else.
Well, I feel like if you're really passionate about what you do, a lot of times it doesn't feel different than spending time just doing things you love. It kind of feels like me time.
I wouldn't know what I have to do in me time, to be honest. I'm happy the way it is. It's busy, but it's beautiful.
Yeah, and you've had a lot of successes along the way. You outlined a lot of these really pivotal moments. But did you ever have a moment where there was an incredible challenge or something that just didn't work out that was kind of disappointing? Or can you talk a little bit about anything in your past that might have, you know, shaped the next decisions you made?
What was, I think, pivotal when I was a young professional was that my girlfriend became very ill. And so for 7 years, she's been like super ill, to the extent that sometimes in the morning I just checked out if she was still alive. So for 7 years, that was quite a thing. And so in that period, we together have been studying massively all kinds of alternative ways of life and alternative medication, alternative therapies. And in those spirits, I mean, I hope you understand, today, new age, we maybe have understood that, you know, it's part of our DNA and our lives and who we are. But like 25 years ago, if you as a designer were interested in new age, you're basically an idiot. So it was difficult to find a way to implement more like spiritual ideas or more non-rational ideas, but human ideas into the world of design that was dominated by rationale and logic and concept. So that was very difficult. It's been hard to sometimes find a way to have conversation with like-minded people. And I remember that, of course, at some moment you feel strong, another moment you feel weak. And I told my girlfriend, it's so terrible. It's like I talk to no one. Nobody gets it. And then she says, well, I can find no one who I can talk to. And then she said, well, but just imagine there is someone that you could talk to. How would they find you? And that was such a beautiful thing to say. And I was so shocked by the sheer simplicity of what she said, but how beautiful it was. And so I thought, yeah, if I can't find them, you know, they can't also find me. And so basically I started writing down what I kind of had deducted from this life. And I built a bit of a strategy and a philosophy around design that was mine. And so I wrote the book in 10 chapters on my thinking. And it was great for me. So that was really important. And the book was published in 1996. And the first thing that I made after the book was ready was another chair. And the first thing that was completely like embedding all these points that were in the book was another chair. So it must have been a great thing to put these things in order, to make that blur of thoughts, to make that come alive and then insights that were in that book. And still today, Sometimes I read that little book. It's a little miracle. It's something that I feel very genuinely proud and happy with, that I was able to do that and I had the time to do it. And yeah, basically someone told me you should scream if you want to be heard. It's something that is beautiful. Sometimes you have to scream if you want to be heard.
Was that a vulnerable process or a cathartic process or both?
I think I've always been a little bit of a bold guy, so I don't think it's a vulnerable situation to write down what you think. I don't feel I make myself very vulnerable to say what I feel. Of course, if you think about everything, which I think as a designer you kind of do, then you live in that blur of questions and cracks in the surface and opportunities and possibilities. If you want to make your own thoughts complete, then at some point you have to decide how you can make it more precise. So you have to at some point write it down. You have to decide, okay, this belongs to this, this belongs to this, this is how I explain myself this, and this is how I explain someone else that. And so you have to write it down. And that's something that as a designer, basically we're not writers. So it's tough. It's difficult to do it well. But I felt I have to do it. And so, I did it. Yeah.
I'm curious, having done that, has it served you as a sort of roadmap or a reminder of your purpose and your direction at times?
Yeah, for sure. It served me, I would say, in the first place, that when it was done, it was clear to myself what I thought. Because again, you think about 1,000 things, but if you can bring it back to 10, now you've got something to work with. Now you've got something that you can follow. Now you've got something to do. And I remember, I thought like, oh my God, I was always so busy. Now, when I write this down, I'm going to be so busy. But the beautiful thing was that when I wrote all this down, I looked at the projects I was doing and I was like, there's 30, 40% of the projects that I don't have to do. Someone else maybe, but I don't have to do those anymore. So it's really nice if you really know what you're doing, what you're trying to prove, who you're trying to be. But of course, and now that book is, you know, it's an old book, so I don't use it for that anymore. But it's fun for me to read it back and see how these 10 insights have each of them has kind of grown out to be more mature, more deep, more researched, more proven. So it's beautiful. So it's still important to me, but we're happily further developed today.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey, Clever listeners, we're getting excited for New York Design Week in May. This year will be better than ever. ICFF, North America's leading platform for contemporary design, will take place from May 19th to the 21st at the Javits Center in New York City. I'll be there, and I'm excited to let you know how Clever is collaborating with ICFF for Launchpad at Wanted, formerly known as Wanted Design Manhattan, and the Emerging Designer Showcase. Launchpad is an international platform for emerging designers that introduces new concepts and showcases prototypes of furniture, home accessories, and lighting. It is the best place for manufacturers to meet new designers, discover fresh ideas, and potential products to develop. The best of Launchpad winners will be selected by a jury of renowned industry professionals, led by yours truly. And they will go on to be featured in another edition of the popular Emerging Designers Showcase. I'll be leading the Emerging Designers Showcase live on the Talks main stage, where the five Launchpad finalists will have a chance to present their projects to our esteemed panel of professionals. It's always a really good time. So mark your calendars for Sunday, May 19th at 4 p.m. Both Launchpad and the Emerging Designer Showcase are presented with media partners Clever, that's us, and Design Milk, and with support from American Standard and Lumens. Visit ICFF.com to learn more and register to attend. Those are the letters ICFF.com. Come by and say hi. I would love to see you there. Support for Clever comes from Wix Studio. Instead of reading you another, let's be honest, boring ad script, Wix Studio just sent me this wild-looking Alice in Wonderland-themed website to scroll through and tell you about. So, whoa. This is not the web I'm used to. There's something called mouse parallax, which makes it feel like you can go deeper into the screen. And as I scroll down, it's like I'm falling down the rabbit hole. And things are moving in depth and perspective. Even my cursor has morphed into a glowing little orb. There are all these no-code animations that make this place feel organic and alive. And Alice is wearing some pretty cool shoes, by the way. Okay, I know I'm mixing up my narratives now, but we are definitely not in Kansas anymore. Your turn to go down the rabbit hole. Build your next web project on Wix Studio, the platform for agencies and enterprises. You've really made an illustrious catalog of work in the product and furniture and interiors categories. But recently, I think you told me you went and got an MBA, and I know you've been city hopping a bit, living for a stint in San Francisco and Milan. And yeah. I'm wondering what's going on with current Marcel. You seem like you're on a new chapter of exploration.
Well, I lived all my life in Amsterdam. I've always traveled a lot, like half of my time, but still I live in Amsterdam and I consider myself an Amsterdamer, which is great. I love the city and I don't want to ever move. But I also felt like it's a bit strange that if I wouldn't have become a designer or I wouldn't have had my studio, I probably would have lived for 2 years in New York and 1 year in London. And maybe that's all an illusion, but that's an illusion. It makes me happy, so I have it. And so that would have been good for me. It's good for people, I think, to travel. And so I have never done really living somewhere else. And I thought, like, maybe if I organize myself well, and this is like 10 years ago, maybe later I can start doing this. And because now it was difficult because my studio is not organized for me not to be there. My daughter is not old enough for me to be away. And I was doing quite a few real estate projects in Amsterdam, which needed my presence. And so I thought, like, I'm going to organize that. Something like 3-4 years ago, I felt, you know, it's time to do this. And so I told myself, we're going to do 5 years, 5 cities. More or less, right? It's just a bit of an idea. It's a concept that can be changed. So ultimately what I did in 2014, I did my MBA at INSEAD in Fontainebleau near Paris. An amazing experience that was so vital for me, you know, to work with such different type of people on such different type of knowledge and such different type of opportunities. It was amazing. Then the year after having my MBA, I thought, let's go to San Francisco. Let's work with venture capital firms. Let's work with startups. And so I did. I became an advisor to venture capital firms, and I worked together with some startups. And then after, I went to Milano. I was there for a lot that year. And then this year, I'm a lot in Budapest and Amsterdam. So I take a little bit of a leap year. And then next year, I might go to Doha.
Let's talk about your creative process, because that's a pretty magical mind under that mop of gray hair. How does it go down?
So inspiration, people think it comes from traveling or from reading books or so. But inspiration, according to me, sits inside. Inspiration is the burning fire that drives everything you are, that drives everything you think. It is basically the big question of your life. What do you do here? What's important? How do you do that? Or how can I make a design topology that's more humanistic, that's more romantic, that's less technocratic, that is more durable, and that generates psychological sustainability in the world? So that is a question. That is the purpose of everything I am. That is what I'm going to prove. That's what I'm going to do. And so everything I see, everything I read, everything I hear, everything I smell, everything that comes my way is selected on this magnetic question. That question is a big, big, big magnet. And if anything passes by that can be meaningful in any way on that subject, to be a little bit of a part of an answer of that subject, it will stick on my brain and will not leave.
Ah.
So the inspiration is that question. The answers come from outside. And they come from any possible direction, of course. Sometimes, you know, crazy shit happens in it and still is meaningful to a thought. You never know. But the inspiration is inside. That's a question that is with me for 25 years, and it hardly changed.
Are there any conditions you can create for yourself that are conducive to synthesizing all of that stimuli?
No, the only thing that I have to do is not sleep.
Oh.
I hardly have a good idea when I sleep. So not sleeping is a good thing.
Oh, interesting. I am way less productive when I'm not sleeping.
Let's explain it this way. If you tie me on a chair, you blindfold me in the dark, I'll be inspired. My inspiration comes from inside. There's always, you know, I'm active. And I'm telling myself this also to make sure that there will never be a situation that I feel I cannot be creative. Because I don't accept any rules for creativity. It will be there because I demand it to be there. I'm not going to be in a position that, oh, I can't travel, so I can't work. There's nothing nice to read. I have no ideas. Fuck that. There's no rules for creativity. I will find the answers on my questions. I will. Nothing can stop that.
Follow-up question. If you're this ever-flowing fountain of ideas, what's your editing process like? I mean, are all these ideas worthy, or do you have to toss them out? And if so, what's your criteria?
I make huge amount of irrelevant and unimportant things. And the good thing is that sometimes that's something I see myself. sometimes my clients or my friends, they hold me back, say like, Marcel, are you crazy? Or this is not worthwhile. And sometimes, you know, nobody sees it and the market thinks like, what was this guy sniffing? I don't know. Of course, we have all these layers of people and systems to find out what are the best things. And, you know, of course, a big part of that selection process is my own hunch, my own experience and my own interest in things. But, you know, sometimes you feel that your clients are holding you back and sometimes super frustrating. But I remember myself, I work with people I respect. I work with people I trust have the best interest in this project. So if they want to stop it, they might know something or feel something that I don't. I think there's always a way to make all the parties in the program excited, happy, and cooperative. There's always a way.
I was going to ask you about that because clients are clearly coming to you because you've created this brand and you have this wonderful mind that creates playful and surprising things. But how are you able to communicate that like in a client meeting and translate all of those thoughts into something that the client can kind of understand?
We do work and it's visible. So people come our way and that's cool. And we try to really connect to the nicest ones and the most friendly people because we like to work with friendly people, generous and friendly people. And so then we start listening. We start to listen to people because if we work with people that we respect, then I'm not going to tell them what to do. I'm going to ask them, what are we going to do? Basically, if I think about what we do in general, if I make an object, I feel that it's my baby, right? So, and of course, if it's my baby, I'm the mother. And the client, my client is the father. And so obviously, to make good babies, you have to make sure that you find a beautiful father, because you can't make a beautiful child with an ugly father. You can't make an intelligent child with a dumb father. So you find good fathers. Now, if you have that father, you have to make sure that he gets a chance to put his genetic information, his quality, his power, his superpowers, he has to be able to put that in that project. And so you want to work together. I mean, you want to make sure also that the father at the end of the line, when the baby is out, that the father recognizes the child as his. Otherwise, he doesn't take care of it. So yeah. All that makes sure that if you listen, and if you are with a client together on a project, of course, if you show a drawing, he recognized that drawing from the conversation you had before. So it becomes more easy to explain what you want to do. And it's not just like only a big surprise. It's a surprise, but it's also a recognition. People see, yes, that's really, we talked about that. And now I see it real. It's different than I thought, but it's the thing, right? So you want to make sure that you have a positive working relationship with respect to get the best of both worlds or all worlds, let's say it that way, into the project.
I love that analogy because so often when babies are born, you can recognize both parents and the baby, but they never look like what you would imagine a hybrid of those two individuals would look like. So that element of the father being able to recognize itself so that he can take care of the project is super important.
I hear stories of designers that, you know, they did design a chair for company X, and then the company X doesn't want it, and they go with the same drawing to company Y, and I don't know, I've tried it once or twice, it never works, and I don't want it to work. It's ridiculous if it could work. It's like being a cuckoo. You put the egg in someone else's nest. It's not what I am. I'm a nest builder. I build nests.
Okay.
I build nest, yeah. Yeah, there might be cuckoo in my nest. Yeah.
Okay, so you've had a pretty public life. I mean, you're on the map as a designer. You've done a lot of interviews, a lot of public speaking, a lot of appearances. Do you think the general public's perception of you is who you are? And often designers don't have a chance to really talk about much more than their last project in media opportunities. So I want to know if there's something that you think the people would be surprised to learn about you.
Well, I'm sure there's a huge amount of things they don't know. And whatever I do or say, the amount of talk that goes around the world is just like incredible. And it could be funny if it wasn't so dramatic sometimes. I don't know. I don't know exactly what people think. Just the other day, I was on a website, and it's some celebrity website. You put a name in, and then you get all kinds of information about that guy, which is given by people who read those things. And it turned out that 40% of the people think I'm bisexual. So that, for instance, is something that people think, and I know it's not true. I did some experimentations, but, you know, I really have no talent on the subject. So, yeah, people think things. I don't know. They come up with ideas. I mean, whatever. I think I'm very open. There's very little I hide. I don't. A lot of people need a lot of privacy. I don't. There's really not so much that, you know, that I want to hide in my life. I mean, I have a fun life. You know, if you make a photo while I have fun, just enjoy the ride. It's my life. I'm not difficult to people. I'm a friendly person. So I don't know. I don't have so much privacy issues. And I think I'm pretty open in what I think and what I feel. And so basically, theoretically, people could really understand who I am, but I think at the end, what they really think about me, I don't know. But you might have an idea. What do people think about me? If I ask it, of course, I don't get the real answers. You might have asked it, and you might have gotten an answer.
You know, that's an interesting question. I think that you definitely give off kind of a swagger and a charisma that I think intimidates people and excites people. So then the shallow, simple people will come to really shallow, simple conclusions about you. And the more thoughtful people will investigate your work and think about your humor and the way that you're willing to challenge things.
I'll tell you something else. The really thoughtful people in design are the most difficult ones, because the people who think about design, they have an opinion about how things should be. And so they become design fundamentalists, because they think that now, because they know how things should be done, they think that therefore they know how I should do my work, which of course is ridiculous.
It's
design fundamentalism, right? I mean, we don't want it in the politics, but in design, it's the one treatment that we give each other. It's
counterproductive to the whole design process.
The whole point of design is that we have different opinions and that we can excite each other with a new idea.
Yes.
Instead, the people who really think they know design, they have their own idea and they think everybody should follow that principle, which is ridiculous. Design fundamentalism is a big thing. We should write a book about it. It would be so much fun. It would be a very cynical book, I think, which maybe I therefore shouldn't make. If you think about what people think about things, it's really dominated by what they think for themselves. They think, I want to do design this way, or I think this is the right way. And then obviously, if someone else doesn't do that or takes more liberties, then basically that is a whore, or it is something that has no mentality or spine and is doing the wrong things, works for the wrong people, blah, blah. It's an interesting subject. We don't have to talk about this in length because it's really not a nice subject, but it's maybe something you could study and let me know what you think.
Haters gonna hate, right?
No. Don't make it so small. It's bigger.
Okay.
It's more ubiquitous than a few people that do hate other people. It's really, see, we all think that, you know, this design stuff, it's so important. So we think about it or we don't, or we take the thoughts from someone else and we make it ours. We work with it day and night. And then obviously it must be right. And if it's right, then other people must do the same. And if they don't, they're basically wrong. So it is something that all of us have if we are not very careful.
Yes, I see what you're saying.
It's not a few people. It's most of us. I have to fight it myself. I see work and I'm like, And I really try to be straightforward and think, like, okay, this is not my work. This doesn't have to follow my rules. Let's look at it again. And I'm trying. It's very easy to be a fundamentalist because you don't have to doubt your life, but it's healthy to doubt.
Yeah,
I agree with that. And I think that the idea of design fundamentalist, I mean, that kind of crosses over to anything, right, into your life and how you view the world.
Sure, absolutely.
Okay, so we talked about the fact that you don't have me time, but do you derive fulfillment from anything you do or anything outside of work? Do you have a hobby?
I've got great friends, and I've got my family, and I've got a little boat here in the canal, which in the summer is nice, and... No, a very simple man, a very simple guy. I don't have strange hobbies, no. Not at all, in fact. I do nothing. I read books.
Wait, do you read like fiction or nonfiction, or is it only design books?
Only nonfiction.
Nonfiction.
I read stuff about the brain, about psychology, and nanostructures, finance, whatever. Everything I don't know, and that's a lot. So,
you like to keep learning. It also sounds like human connection is something that you like to.
Absolutely. It's the key.
We all do.
The key to happiness, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Alone, happiness, no.
Yeah, isolation, not really. No good.
All right. Back to your studio. What's the future of your studio? What's exciting? What would you love to do? Or where would you love for it to go?
Well, we have a fantastic studio. We're about 50 people. And the studio is, it's a very special place. We started doing product design. We started now to do interior design for a few years. The philosophy of my work, things are always... whole. They're always like, you have to look at them from all sides. If I make a cup, I don't care about the ceramic. I care about everything. And so basically, we look at projects from all kinds of ways. Everything becomes an opera. Everything has 1,000 things to be decided on. And so the teams are very multidisciplinary. And that's something that's so beautiful, because you get all these specialists that work together in such a wonderful way. And for a special project, sometimes we take aboard other people that have a crazy specialism. It could be a poet, could be psychologist, could be whatever, a police guy. We find people and we get them into the studio to make our projects vital and to get knowledge that otherwise we wouldn't have. We have photographers in house, we have graphic designers, we have virtual designers, we have all these kind of people, and they work together. I think that's something that is going to shape the result of our projects in the future. You see also that, you know, where we used to do a chair for a company, today we design a collection and we explain exactly how to present it. We work together with the companies on how to PR it and to photograph it and how to put it in the stores and basically how tomorrow to be just a more interesting company. And that's cool. I like to learn. I'm born to learn. I'm bored fast. And so I really love to find areas that I don't know how to do it. And so I find people around me that help us create and that help me learn. And so the studio is a place of creative superheroes. And it's wonderful to lead them to do something that we're all going to be happy and proud of.
So speaking of the studio and all the superheroes, you've stated your mission is here to create an environment of love, live with passion, and make our most exciting dreams come true.
Yeah, that's a mission. I wrote down probably like 22 years ago. It's really fun. I put the comma different, but then it goes back. It's not, nothing has ever changed.
That's a grand mission, and it's one that feels very celestial and open-ended. And so I wonder if you can define, like, personally, what your most exciting dream is that has yet to come true. Can you put any descriptors to that?
Big picture. I mean, the small picture. I want to do so many wonderful projects and make little steps. I think the world is dominated by the thought that the big steps are so important. I just love the small steps. I love little victories. I can have 15 on a day, and I love that. And I really think that we're over committed to the big steps, because, you know, big steps really cannot happen without small steps. So you ask what I really want for the future of my life and my studio, I want us to do a huge amount of little victories, a huge amount of little victories, and enjoy all of them, because that is what's going to make us happy. It's nice if in 5 years' time we did something, but basically if it means that for the 5 years in between, we just work hard and just like hope it's happening, I'd rather have 15,000 little victories. Having said that, two things that really I'm bound to do, I'm really want to do it. I want to do an opera in the Met in New York. I really want to take that universe and just make it completely kind of take over the experience that people have. We make products, we make interiors, and in an interior, you basically invite people to feel things, to experience things. But in an opera, now it's like you kind of have them completely. I mean, they cannot escape anymore. And so they're on that train with me, and I'm just going to, you know, give them that unique, everlasting memory of an experience that is just like, yeah, once in a lifetime. So that is something I really, really, really want to do. And I want to do it once only. So I'm going to do one opera and it's going to be in the Met. So you can't buy tickets yet, but, you know, be prepared. It's going to happen. And then the other thing I want to do is I want to do a big Grand Mosque in the Middle East. It is a super interesting as a creative project. I think more than that, I think the design is political activity and it has a huge influence on what people think in the world. It is a force for good, and it's important that through design we make connections through cultures, and also especially where, you know, it is important to show that, you know, people can work together and can respect each other. And so therefore, I think it would be amazing if the right people in the Middle East trust me to make them a great mosque. And if then I can make them the most amazing mosque ever, that is truly contemporary, but it's truly a celebration of their wonderful culture. And that's something I really want to do. And I started researching, and that's a project I kind of started with studying. I do a lot of studies for mosques. But also that's going to take a while. It's going to be at least 10 years from now that, you know, maybe I can start, because it's a new language that I have to study, but I'm on that.
Wow. I'm excited for both of those.
What do you have coming up that our listeners should take note of and be on the lookout for?
Oh, tonight I'm going to have dinner with friends.
Wait, are we all invited?
Yeah, if you come over, you're more than happy to do the espresso at the end of the night. What we should know now, I mean, we are opening very soon a hotel in Doha, which is an amazing hotel. It's a Mondrian hotel. It's a sister of the Mondrian that we did in Miami, but it's real Doha. That's a big thing for me and my studio. Of course, there's the fair in Milano coming up, and we all know what that means, right, Amy?
Yes.
That's going to be great fun. And this year, we're going to show, you know, a lot of cool stuff, a lot of new things. With Moy, we have a very special presentation this year. Even for people who have been there year on year, they're going to be happily surprised to see us in a new way. Yeah, super interesting stuff. I hope that people visit us also in the real in our New York showroom. Everybody's always welcome, and we're happy to share what we do there.
I want to thank you for being so candid and sharing your personal vision for changing the world with us.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Take care, Marcel. Fun. Hope to see you soon.
I want to be inside of his brain. I love that he talked about inspiration being something that's inside of him that he can channel. He said he makes a lot of work, you know, and sometimes he shows it to people and they're like, no, you shouldn't do that. And then some people are like, yes, this is an amazing idea. So I think it's really important to look at inspiration as something that comes from actually making things or writing things down or just trying all kinds of things. It's more about the amount of work and being prolific and then finding something within all of that that works, rather than just like sitting around waiting for, like, you know, the sunset to inspire you to make something.
Like, you can't go out in search of an epiphany, right?
Right.
But I think it's really important that he said it's something inside, because so many people think that inspiration is an external thing that they have to find from somewhere, as opposed to a nourishing of your internal world with external stimuli. And I think it's a parallel to self-worth. People sometimes look for their self-worth in external validation, and it's ultimately a recipe for failure and emotional instability and energetic meltdowns. Sometimes external validation can nourish your self-worth, but your self-worth comes from within, and you're in charge of feeding it with the types of things that you seek out and the way that you take care of it. And inspiration is the same way. You're in charge of feeding it and taking care of it, but it's inside already. You just have to like maintain the apparatus.
Right.
I also loved the way he talked about a project is a baby, which we can all relate to, right? When we give our creative selves over to a project, it really is like birthing a baby. And I didn't get a chance to ask him about postpartum, because that I have a legit question about whether he feels the up and down of giving birth to a project. But this two-parent situation, these two genetic inputs that have to happen to create this project, and absolutely, the father has to recognize himself in this baby, or else he won't feel compelled to take care of it. And that idea of like the hopeful designer going around with this portfolio full of ideas, client after client saying, you know, don't you want to make my project? You can see now how that doesn't work. It has to start with this communion of two genetic identities, and then it has to be born from that.
Yeah. And I think that the brands, you know, they come to him for something in particular. They don't come to him because he designed a chair and they want to make it. They come to him because of his brain and the creativity and the studio's message that they put out there. So, you know, designers not only need to be able to make or design beautiful things, but they also need to have a mission and a philosophy. And I love that he wrote that down like right away in the beginning, so that people kind of know exactly who he is and what he stands for and what he wants his studio to make and how he wants them to be presented.
Okay, one last thing I think that was really awesome about this, and I'm gonna remind myself to practice this: the small victories. A gazillion small victories in your lifetime, I think, is ultimately a more enjoyable life than, you know, years and years of misery and hard labor
for
like the one big victory, right? Which we all know doesn't have as big of an impact as we think it does. You can't live forever off like one accomplishment. So celebrating the small victories, I think, is exactly what keeps your engine fired up to keep doing more.
Absolutely. Hey, thanks for listening. Before we wrap this up, we have some exciting news. We're producing our first sponsored episode in collaboration with Interface, and we can't wait to share it with you. It's one of our favorite topics, the changing workplace. We're going to talk to two people in the commercial design and contract industry about how the way we work is affecting design and how the design industry is responding to these changes. Plus, it's all about positivity, so earmark this and stay tuned.
And subscribe to Clever on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Go to cleverpodcast.com to sign up for our newsletter, read the show notes, and see images of Marcel's work. Connect with us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Clever Podcast. We totally love hearing from you. This episode of Clever was edited by Ty Navarez with music by L1011.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.